This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Governor Phil Scott signed two bills yesterday that extend protections for victims of sexual assault and domestic violence. Some of the changes have been a long time coming for the advocates who work on these issues. The laws make dramatic changes to the statute of limitations for sexual assault and child exploitation, create a sexual assault survivor's bill of rights, and make improvements to how rape kits are managed. Today on the program, we're going to find out what these new laws do and what the changes will mean to victims of these crimes. I'm joined today by Auburn Watersong, Policy Director of the Vermont Network Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. Auburn, it's a pleasure to have you here.
Thanks so much, Jane.
And also with us is Representative Maxine Grad of Moortown, Chair of the House Judiciary Committee, and she introduced one of the laws we're discussing today. Representative Grad, it's nice to have you on the program as well.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Auburn, it seems like Vermont has pretty strong laws against sexual assault and domestic violence. So why were new actions needed to protect Vermonters?
Mm-hmm. We do have some strong laws on the books. We wanted to improve the system that supports survivors through the process. We felt that the Survivor's Bill of Rights would ensure basically standards of best practice across the state so that victims were assured their rights with regard to medical care, handling of evidence collection, confidential support and services and information. And so we were looking at definitely improving that through the Survivor's Bill of Rights. And then also we were sort of on a little behind the times around the statute of limitations issue with regard to sexual assault. 34 states have statute of limitations in some way, from 3 years to 30 years. We were one of only 11 states that had a statute of limitations on sexual assault that was 6 years or under.
And ours was 6 years.
So so it was time to look at, if not increasing that statute of limitations, eliminating it altogether, which has really sort of been the movement nationally. And so we were able to get that passed with a commitment of wonderful leadership like Representative Grad.
And in terms of what the new law says, it does eliminate the statute of limitations for
sexual
crimes.
Assault. Mm-hmm.
And in terms of child exploitation, child pornography, it extends it to 40 years.
40 years. Yeah.
Maxine Grad, you introduced this bill that we're talking about. It was H-74, now called Act 44. And it does have a number of things. They're not all related, except that they relate to sexual assault and domestic violence. Why was this something that you felt compelled to be a leader on?
Well, I have been very interested in victims' issues for a number of years now. I've served for 17 years so far. And as we just heard, while Vermont is leading the way, there was more work to be done. And these bills originated as a number of different bills, and then we felt that it would be really more powerful to put them together in what has become a comprehensive set of laws protecting survivors of sexual violence.
What were the debates or the discussions like in the legislature when you brought these up?
Actually, there wasn't a whole lot of debate. I believe they passed out of my committee unanimously. There was a lot of support. There was a little concern in terms of the statute of limitations, in terms of memory and things like that, but those really all go to the prosecution, and those are issues that exist now. So it really did have tripartisan support.
We're talking today, again, about domestic violence, sexual assault, and the law, how it works in Vermont, and some updates that were just signed into law yesterday by Governor Scott. So if it seemed like such an easy win in the legislature in some ways, Auburn, why was this something that you felt like was, if not a struggle, at least something that you had to be advocating for a number of years?
Right. Well, we had seen, like I said, a national conversation happening around sexual violence. And certainly over the recent years, with what had happened with the Catholic Church situation, conversations around that, conversations around Bill Cosby and those trials, the conversation around sexual violence and statutes of limitations and what our Survivor's Bill of Rights had really ramped up quite a bit. I should mention that Amanda Nguyen from the organization RISE. She was the lead advocate on the federal Survivors Bill of Rights.
Which was passed under President Obama in 2016, I believe, right?
Right, right. He signed that in October last year. And she's been working hard to make sure that states like Vermont do bring this back to the state level and make sure that states are on board with this. We were number nine in the list of states, and there's actually 11 states now that have a Sexual Violence Survivors Bill of Rights, so we're really proud to be on the forefront of that. And
let's talk a little bit about that Survivors Bill of Rights and what it actually entails. Representative Gratt, are there points in the Survivors Bill of Rights that you would like to highlight that you think are really important for people to know about?
Sure. I'll talk about it more generally, and then perhaps Armin can talk about it specifically. But it really brings parity in health care to survivors of sexual assault, and it diminishes the risk of being re-victimized during an exam and during the legal process. And that was something that that has been missing for many times, and I think it impacted victims' willingness to come forward, and also the success of these cases being actually prosecuted. And so it really was a justice issue, an access to justice issue, as well as a healthcare issue, because in all other aspects of healthcare, there is coverage, and Arvin can talk a little bit more about it. So it really leveled the playing field, as well as diminish the risk of being re-traumatized.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so Auburn, let's talk about a few of the specifics in it so people can get a handle on what this Bill of Rights actually entails. And it actually, the person who reports a crime to a law enforcement officer or a hospital is now expected to get in writing this Bill of Rights, which includes things like you have the right to receive a medical forensic examination and any related toxicology testing at no cost to the survivor, irrespective of whether the survivor reports to or cooperates with law enforcement. Mm-hmm. And it goes on from there. There are several points within that point about how a forensic examination may be conducted and what rights the survivor has, including the right to have that kit stored for the duration of the statute of limitations.
Right, which is now lifted, and which we have heard from the forensic lab is not going to put at risk any deterioration of the contents of the forensic kit. So that was good news to hear that as well.
Were these things not happening already at Vermont hospitals and police departments?
Some were. What we've done by creating this Bill of Rights is, like I said, we've standardized practice. So, for example, the right to have a medical forensic examination kit delivered to the laboratory within 72 hours. We sort of had a patchwork of delivery systems around Vermont. They're usually worked out locally between hospitals and law enforcement officers how the forensic exam might get from the hospital to the lab. And they may or may not have gotten there within 72 hours. They might linger in the process. And so now we've really standardized that as best practice. And we know that, like, for example, Vermont State Police already had that in their protocol. So so it's really all the players were on board with this kind of these rights that we've enumerated here. It's just a way of getting us all on the same page.
Well, and now you have a document that you can hand to
exactly,
somebody too, right?
Exactly, right. Yes. And then as we go forward, you know, we may be able to collect data and get some feedback on whether or not which items are being met and not, and whether we need to make tweaks in the system. So.
Yeah, a couple others I'll mention just for people if this is new for you. The right to consult with a sexual assault advocate, the right to information concerning the availability of protective orders and policies related to the enforcement of protective orders. Representative Grad, do you hear from people that, you know, that this information has been missing when they either report a crime or go to the hospital for treatment after a sexual assault, that some of that information hasn't necessarily been getting to them?
I have heard that, yes. So that's why I'm so thrilled about this new law.
Let's go to Kanna, who's calling in from Milton. Hi, Kanna. Go right ahead.
Hi. It sounds so far like the bill is mostly aimed at sexual violence, and I'm wondering about the domestic violence portion, if there's a piece of funding aimed at offenders. There used to be funding for groups for offenders to help hold them accountable and help change their behavior, and I'm wondering if that's part of any of this at all.
Representative Grad?
Actually, I'll defer to Auburn, who knows more about funding.
But in terms of what the law, this act does not have anything related to that.
Right. This is pertaining to sexual violence.
So Auburn, what about funding that's out there beyond this law?
So I think the caller was asking about domestic violence accountability programming mm-hmm. for perpetrators. And right now we have community-based programming for folks who commit violence against their partners. And that programming is funded by sliding scale fees, typically, that the perpetrators are supposed to pay to the facilitators to participate in those programs. We no longer have any state funding supporting those programs, so that's been an issue that the network's been advocating for a few years now, trying to make sure that those facilitators can keep their training and certification up and keep the standards up to par in the local communities. But right now, they are dependent upon the perpetrators funding that, and so that's a challenge. That's definitely a challenge.
Is that something that you feel is worth working on? I mean, is that something?
Absolutely, absolutely. We need to do that, especially where right now, you know, we hear a lot of conversation around decreasing incarcerative remedies, or decreasing the incarceration rate, and that kind of thing. And so we need to be open to looking at what do offenders need in the communities that they live in? What do they need so that they're held accountable and actually can make some positive changes? And we do hear from victims that oftentimes victims would rather have their perpetrator change than be incarcerated. So we do need to think more deeply and broadly and put more resources toward this kind of programming.
Auburn, you were mentioning that some of the things that have been coming up that are just out there in the public sphere have been leading to people thinking that maybe a change could be necessary in the statute of limitations for sexual assault in Vermont and child exploitation, things like the case against Bill Cosby. Mm-hmm. So could you explain a little bit why it's important to have a longer term or a lifetime to come forward and report a crime? You know, why is that something that you advocate for instead of somebody having a shorter time to be able to say this thing happened to me and I would like to prosecute?
Right, right. So it's really about the nature of trauma and the nature of sexual violence. So sexual violence can be very, very private. It can be very hard for victims to come forward for any number of reasons. They may be so traumatized that their memory is affected. Their perpetrator may be a family member. I know that, you know, victims of that I've worked with who've had their perpetrators have been family members have like made calculated decisions on when to come forward and when, you know, how long to wait and what other family members will be upset or supportive or not if I come forward. And those kinds of calculations are always in the mind of a victim. And truly, I mean, the data tells us that perpetrators are more often known to the victim than, stranger rapes are more rare. And so that complicates the whole process about when a victim is feeling ready to come forward. There's also the possibility of what's called grooming behaviors, where the perpetrator befriends and creates an affectionate connection with a victim. And so that complicates the relationship and when the victim is ready to separate and come forward as well. So there's just, it's such a complex and complicated situation oftentimes that we just need to allow for a length of time until the victim is ready to come forward. And we know in Vermont, we've had cases of 30, 40 years. So, you know, the victim was ready 40 years later. So that's what we're trying to accommodate.
Representative, go ahead.
If I could just add, somebody reached out to me when the victim learned about the law, and 40 years was not enough for this victim. And the perpetrator in that particular case was a very prominent member of the community. And so so really what we're saying here is no longer survivors, victims, do you need to live in that fear or shame and silence and therefore breaking those barriers and creating the much needed access to justice and to healing.
One other thing, Representative Grad, that's in this bill is a change that you've made to relief from abuse orders, and it now applies specifically and in a delineated way to all kinds of contact, not just physical distance. So in the past, we've often heard about, you know, somebody must keep a certain number of feet away from a victim in a relief from abuse order. And now this applies to all different kinds of communication. So why was that important to include?
That actually is current practice. And what we did here was we codified current practice. And it's important because we know that whether it's text messaging and perpetrators, it's no longer, what is it, lying in wait, in the bushes or anything. It's often the text messages, the cell phone calls. It's the use of social media and electronic means is a very powerful and frightening way in which a perpetrator can terrorize his or her victim.
And so now what was being done in practice is just written into the law.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Representative Maxine Grad is from Moortown. Thank you very much for talking with us about your bill and about this issue.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Today we're learning more about how domestic violence and sexual assault are dealt with legally in Vermont with Auburn Watersong, Policy Director of the Vermont Network Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. One of the laws enacted yesterday deals specifically with rape kits. And to learn a little bit more about that, let's bring another voice into the conversation. Sarah Robinson coordinates the Sexual Assault Nurse Examiners Program. She coordinates the work of forensic nurses across Vermont who conduct medical exams on victims of sexual assault. Sarah, it's nice to have you with us today.
Thanks so much for having me on, Jane.
This may be, and thankfully so, unfamiliar territory for a lot of people. So for people who have not experienced it, can you explain a little bit how rape kits or forensic exams are conducted in Vermont?
Absolutely. And this is a valuable service that's available in many communities across the state, but occurs really quietly and below the radar for many of us. So right now in Vermont, there are 53 sexual assault nurse examiners, which we refer to as SANE nurses. And these are nurses that are primarily based in hospital emergency rooms, and they receive specialized training to provide forensic medical care to patients who experience sexual assault and abuse. And about 14 of those nurses have additional specialized training that helps them treat child victims of sexual abuse. So these SANE nurses collect forensic evidence of possible crimes and document their findings according to a standardized evidence kit that's used across the state. And SANE nurses also play a really valuable role connecting victims with resources such as victim advocates and providing trauma-informed care to victims of sexual assault to help them assist in both their physical and their emotional healing.
Sarah, you said there are 53 SANE nurses in the state of Vermont?
There are currently, yes.
And are SANE nurses the only ones who are authorized to conduct a forensic exam, what many people would call a rape kit?
Right. So SANE nurses receive this special training that assists them. So they're very familiar with the evidence kit. So any medical professional can collect evidence and submit that evidence to the Vermont Forensic Lab. But what we know and hear from our partners across the criminal legal response, from prosecutors, from law enforcement agencies, and from victims, is that receiving care from a SANE nurse ensures that the standards of evidence collection are really best practice and there the highest standards of evidence collection, and this ensures that the evidence that's collected can be useful in a future criminal proceeding.
So, Auburn, what changed now with the signing of Act 68 yesterday?
Okay, so when the governor signed the bill was S-95 originally, what it basically did was it improved access to these nurses. So there are a few hospitals in the more rural areas in the state that don't have or have very limited access to these forensic nurses. In some cases, we had victims that were waiting for those services, and we wanted to make sure that they had, you know, timely access at their local hospital. So in other cases, we had some victims that needed to travel to another hospital. And so we wanted to find a way to make that happen. So that what this bill does is it allows for a collaborative process to happen in different areas of the state, whereby the collaborators, different hospitals, can pool their resources to provide, to make sure there's forensic care available to when victims show up at their local hospitals. So that was one very big piece of this legislation, which we were very excited about. And then also, it also ensures continued funding for the clinical coordinator position of this program, which is we have right now a full-time position.
That's Sarah's position?
Sarah is actually a program coordinator, and then we have clinical coordinator as well. And the clinical coordinator right now is staffed by two emergency room nurses who are also certified forensic nurses. And they do a lot of the coordinating of the nurses on the ground, and they do all the training. And they also have their feet right in the work. So it's a wonderful, valuable resource. And so we have ensured that funding through this bill going forward. And then we've also launched sort of an effort to look at improving how these rape kits are tracked as evidence from the point of collection to the arrival at the lab. And so we're looking at better handling and managing of that tracking system.
Sarah Robinson, where are the gaps geographically in where these trained nurses, these SANE nurses, are around the state?
Yeah, so as Auburn alluded to, although we have this incredible cadre of trained nurses across the state, their distribution is very uneven. So larger hospitals such as UVM Medical Center or Rutland Regional Medical Center are able to offer 24-hour, 365-day on-call coverage. So if someone walks into the emergency room and presents and says, you know, I need evidence collection related to a sexual assault or I need medical care related to a sexual assault, they're able to see one of these really highly trained nurses. And it's just not possible to provide that level of coverage at many small rural hospitals in Vermont. And so what that means is that, it can be a matter of pure luck whether you live in a community where there's access to this care or not. And that has real implications for court proceedings for those victims moving forward. So, you know, one thing that we are really focused on doing is supporting these innovative efforts to regionalize care so that victims can stay in their own communities, receive care at their own hospital, and not need to travel or wait for hours. So one place that that's happening right now is actually in the Middlebury area. And Porter Hospital in Middlebury for many years had a very small number of very dedicated sexual assault nurse examiners, but at any given time they might have only one or two nurses that have been fully trained and able to provide this care. So Porter Hospital and Parton Health Center at Middlebury College recently collaborated to expand access to sexual assault medical treatment in Middlebury. So there were a number of nurses at Middlebury College who were trained, a number of additional nurses at Porter Hospital that were trained, and those institutions really did a wonderful job of developing an agreement that allows them to share personnel for this purpose. So now rather than Porter Hospital having only one or two SANEs that are trying to share 24-hour coverage, they now have a shared staffing pool of six people that share a call schedule. And so now survivors that go to Porter Hospital for care, it's much, much more likely that they're going to receive care and evidence collection from someone who's highly trained. And we believe that this is a really promising model that other rural communities in Vermont will be able to implement as well.
Auburn, can you put a fine point on this? What is it like as a rape victim to have to wait a long time for a SANE nurse to arrive where you are, or to have to travel to somewhere else to have a rape kit conducted?
Yeah, it's so, you know, if you can imagine a victim going through this traumatic experience, finally coming to the point where she's ready to come forward and get some help. And oftentimes this is right after an incident that she arrives at a hospital looking for this kind of care. It can be, for one thing, this is I always kind of wonder whether I should say this because it's kind of quite emotional, but I feel like one of the things that we forget to recognize when it comes to victims of sexual violence when they present at a hospital is that their body actually becomes the crime scene. And so while they're getting medical care, this evidence collection would normally, you know, if it were a break-in in a home, the crime scene would be the house, and that's where they would do dust for fingerprints and do those kinds of things. So if you can imagine, the exam itself is also invasive, has the potential to feel very traumatic. And so that's why forensic nurses are trained so carefully in how to provide trauma-informed care. So the victim may be anticipating that as well, and needs support through that process. Then if she's sitting and waiting, because the body is a crime scene, you can't clean it, right? She's sitting and waiting and not able to shower. If she's told she needs to go to another hospital, she may then have to, you know, get in a vehicle and drive a distance while she's, you know, feeling emotionally wrought and probably exhausted. In some cases, you know, depending on whether or not she has a support person with her, she may be doing this alone, you know. So it can be a very, very difficult and trying time. So it really is, it's wonderful, actually, that Vermont leadership has really stepped up and said, no, we don't want to allow this to continue to happen. We really want to make sure that the systems can answer the situation right away where she is without her having to jump through hoops or go through any more trauma than what she's already experienced.
And you're using the pronoun she, but I want to point out this law applies to both men and women victims of sexual assault, and there are male victims of sexual assault.
Absolutely, absolutely. Thanks for pointing that out. I do tend to use the pronouns she and her when I'm speaking about victims because it is a gendered phenomenon. We know that the data supports that, but of course, there are male victims, and they would be privy to the same services and rights as female victims. Yeah.
Let's go to Ian on the line with us from Addison. Hi, Ian. Go ahead.
Hello. I have a question sort of related to your last few comments. Who has the ultimate control over what is done with the evidence collected in the rape kit? For example, if the victim and the state disagree on how to pursue the situation, who controls what is actually done with the collected evidence?
Ian, thanks very much for the call. Sarah Robinson, do you know what that chain of command is and chain of mm-hmm. Ownership is?
Sure. So in Vermont, sexual assault kits can be collected from victims whether or not that victim chooses to report the crime to law enforcement. So in effect, if someone chooses to have evidence collected, they're preserving their options for that day or maybe later in the future that they'll choose to report that crime. But whether or not the crime is reported, that kit is sent to the Vermont Forensic Laboratory. And if it's unreported, it's sent confidentially, and local law enforcement don't know, you know, the name of that individual or any identifying information related to that kit. If the crime is reported, then often an investigation is opened. There are varying standards of investigations for investigating sexual assault. But by and large, in Vermont, and there are exceptions as it relates to public safety or as it relates to sexual abuse and assault of children. But by and large, law enforcement agencies in Vermont work really diligently to work with sexual violence victims and to proceed with investigations at the request of sexual violence victims. There are certainly exceptions to that, but by and large, that is how best practice investigation occurs in Vermont.
Auburn, one of the things that this bill that we're talking about now actually does is to create a study committee, a legislative study committee, that will look at how we do rape kits and how we track them and mm-hmm. what happens after they're conducted, that chain of custody, how they're transported, you know, what kind of courier services are being mm-hmm. used to transport it from a medical facility to a forensic laboratory. So what are you hoping will come out of that?
Well, we're really hoping that it's a feasibility study. So we are going to be coming out with, you know, what is this going to take for resources to support what we're looking at. And I think what we're really looking at is creating sort of a standardized system across the state, a standard protocol, if you will, a best practice for delivery, for getting the kits from directly from the hospital through law enforcement to the forensic lab in this timely manner, the 72 hour timeline, and also just making sure that the tracking is accurate. We have technology out there that Vermont's not using right now, something similar to what UPS might use, you know, to zap a package and track it, and you can follow it on its way. And so we could do some of those things to look at, you know, handling of kits and management of that.
And Sarah, just to be clear, we hear in the news in a lot of states that there are really severe backlogs on how long it takes to process a rape kit. We just have a couple of seconds left, but does Vermont have that problem?
Yeah, fortunately, that is not the case here in Vermont. So even though all sexual assault evidence kits are sent to the Vermont Forensic Lab, our lab really does a first-rate job at processing those kits within weeks or months at most. But as Auburn referred to, we have this patchwork system that we rely on to transport those kits from the hospital to the lab. So there's no backlog at the lab itself, but it can sometimes take varying amounts of time for that kit to get from the hospital to the lab, and that's something that this study committee will be looking at.
Well, we look forward to hearing the results. Sarah Robinson coordinates the Sexual Assault Nurse Examiners Program, SANE. Auburn Watersong is Policy Director of the Vermont Network Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. Thanks very much to both of you.
Thank you, Jane.
Thank you, Jane.